All of our interventions are different, so you'll see that ours is different than the first ones and then the last one. And North Carolina, of course, is a little different than San Diego or New York or LA. And so this is the team that in North Carolina, there's not a lot of meth use, although there is meth in the rural areas and in the cities and it was seen a rise since the early 2000s. There have been some things that have, you know, they've passed laws restricting the precursors and things, which have made it harder for the local meth labs to produce. But I think we've seen more of an influx now from Mexico and places. And so I think the availability probably hasn't changed much. The sources have changed. And there's a... we have MSM in North Carolina, and some of them use meth, and so one recent study found that 6% of MSM had used meth in North Carolina had used meth. And the other thing is that like in cities like Raleigh and Durham and even Charlotte, that because there's not large numbers of meth using MSM, we don't have like treatment programs devoted to meth use and MSM. We don't have HIV prevention things for meth use and MSM. There's like a few, you know, like HIV prevention, you know, AIDS Alliance and places that work a lot with MSM. But there's no substance abuse treatment even specifically for meth. You know, it's just, and so it's there's just not the same kind of things there are in the really major urban areas. And so we used a single session motivational intervention based on motivational interviewing. And motivational interviewing has been used for reduced substance use for alcohol and a variety of other things. It's also been used specifically with methamphetamine users in combination with other behavioral therapies to reduce methamphetamine use. It's been used with MSM to reduce HIV and to reduce sexual risk, and we have significant experience with motivational interviewing. I just finished a study using it with injecting drug users to reduce alcohol use to slow hepatitis C progression among them. And single session interventions have been shown to work for reducing alcohol use in problem drinkers, unsafe sex in STD clinic patients, and relatively short doses have been shown to be effective in reducing unprotected anal intercourse among MSM. And it's more cost effective maybe if it works than multiple sessions. And one thing that we know really from all of our intervention work, we know that longer interventions, more intensive interventions work better. But a lot of times people don't come to all of the sessions that you want them to come to. And again, in an area like North Carolina, where we don't have specific things for methamphetamine using MSM, that the organizations that will be providing interventions for meth using MSM have to provide services for other groups too. So they can't have a big program just for that. Okay? And so here's the structure of our study, kind of the baseline. There were three visits. The baseline, we collect informed consent, did the assessment, HIV counseling and testing, gave people their results and paid them, I think it was like $40 for baseline and $50 when they came back at the two-month follow-up. The intervention schedule was the intervention was delivered like 1 to 7 days after the baseline visit, depending on, you know, if it was like on a depending on the person's schedule, kind of when we could get them back. And we had originally wanted it to all be in one visit, but 3.5 hours we decided was a little bit too long for somebody, so we broke it out into two visits. And And the MI session itself was broken into 10 sections, kind of, where, with an introduction, then we talked to people about their meth use and the role that meth played in their life, and then assessing their motivation to change their meth use, their patterns of sexual risk behavior, their what high-risk sexual behavior meant to them, their motivation for changing their sexual risk behavior, and then worked on enhancing either sexual changing sexual risk or methamphetamine use, and then planning, developing a plan for change, and then summarizing what we've done in closing. And in the formative work, we had originally thought, well, we can get them to work on changing meth use and reducing their sexual risk at the same time. But some of the people, it seemed like there were a lot of people thought that was too ambitious to try to do in a single session. And so you know, that for people who felt they could reduce their sexual risk while using meth, you know, that they could use condoms, then we say, okay, well, you can work on, we'll work on reducing your sexual risk. If there were people who said, when I use meth, I just want to have unprotected sex, I'm not going to use a condom, then this focus shifted to reducing their meth use. And so, you know, now, trying to recruit meth using MSM who report having unprotected anal intercourse with a non-primary partner in the past 2 months in North Carolina is challenging. And so we used a lot of different ways to find people, and some of them worked. And we ended up with 39 people. We were hoping to get like between 50 to 80, but we actually, you know, hoped to do this study just in Raleigh and Durham area. But we ended up having to actually open up a little branch office in Charlotte too, just to get these people. And so, the analyses, I guess I didn't do anything fancy. I just used paired tests to look at the pretest, what they were at baseline and what they were at follow-up. The sample, you can see, was about half of them were non-Hispanic white, 44% were African American, 33% were employed, 56% had incomes less than $10,000, 41% were homeless. Okay, so in terms of sexual orientation, 74% identified as gay, 20% as bisexual, and 5% as other. Almost 60% have been in prison and jail, 46% were HIV positive, which is fairly high for North Carolina. I think that, I don't know what the rates are just among a sample of MSM, but I think it's in a study that had MSM in it, it was probably 25% or something. So this is high for MSM in North Carolina, and 28% reported having an STD in the past 12 months. That in terms of people, we lost 8 people for out of these 39 to follow up in the, and I will say one thing, that we had one person for our office in Charlotte. He became ill. He was having trouble with some of his followers, and then he moved to Florida. And I think he was having some allergies or something, and he got better when he moved to Florida. But it was kind of when we were trying to do the follow-ups, we had a couple months left in the study. We couldn't really hire another person, so the project coordinator had to drive from Durham down. He'd schedule follow-up interviews and drive from Durham to Charlotte, which is about 150 miles away, to do the follow-up interviews. So I think maybe that complicated the follow-up stuff. The other thing is that something I will point out is that the guys who we lost tended to be the more, what I would say, kind of white gay men, kind of. They all identify as gay, 75% were white, they tended to have higher incomes, and they were, you know, and the only thing that's kind of inconsistent about that is that most of them injected. So I don't know what, I mean, if, other than that, I would say they were, you know, the kind of your traditional white gay male meth user. Okay, and so here are their sexual behaviors at baseline. That 61% had unprotected intercourse with their receptive Anlayer, of course, with their non-primary partner the last time, 55% in Surtee, even overall it was 61%. The 35% have been drunk in the past 2 months, 10% have used heroin, 28% crack. And at their last sex encounter, 64% reported using methamphetamine, 22% had been drunk, and 7% had used cocaine or crack. And in terms of our outcomes, I just looked at, and this was, I kind of took our frequencies of meth use and converted it into days by saying that if somebody used less than once a month, that it was one time. If they'd used once a month in the past 60 days, it was two. If they used every day, it was 60 times. If they, and so anyway, I just converted it into days. And you see that the frequency dropped from like 14 days in the past 60 days to about four or about five. And then we see a decrease in the frequency of unprotected anal intercourse and also a significant decrease in the and the number of sex partners in the past 2 months. And in terms of their last sex with their non-primary partner, we also saw significant decreases in unprotected anal intercourse and in methamphetamine use at the last sex. And because motivation interviewing is really linked to the trans-theoretical stages of change model, we looked at its effect on stage of change related to unprotected anal sex and to discontinuing methamphetamine use, and we saw significant increases or improvement in stage of change related to those things, which is good because that's what you would hope for. And so there are several limitations to this study. Of course, there's a small sample, there's no comparison group, 2 month follow-up is rather brief, this is one of the few interventions I'm aware of for meth using MSM outside of a major urban area. So it's maybe of interest. And the preliminary findings suggest that the intervention was effective in reducing methamphetamine use and sexual risk. It also suggests that a single session MI intervention was acceptable to meth using MSM, and that single session interventions did, because it was, you know, they were there, they almost everybody completed it, so it wasn't that if it shows, you know, if these results are borne out in like a randomized trial, then this could be something that's useful for organizations in places like North Carolina that want to work with meth using MSM but don't have the resources to have specialized interventions for them. And now this, you know, I mean, this may not be as effective as, say, if you took the matrix model and combined it with something else, which is, I think, what is matrix, like 16 or 18 sessions to get people to stop using meth and then combine some sexual risk reduction stuff with it. But this is something that could be, you know, used in a lot of places potentially, and maybe having a small effect on a lot of people can be, on a population level, can be almost as important as having a big effect on a few people. And so I'd like to acknowledge the funding source and Gordon and our consultants, Michael Ross and Lisa Haito. So.
Since most MSM meth users tend to be a bit more resistant in the interview process, what type of motivational techniques can we know about that you use to get them to open up the interview?
The question was, since most meth using MSM tend to be kind of resistant, that what kind of techniques that we use could we pass on to other people, recommend for other people to use who are working with that population? And I'm the PI, I'm not really an expert in motivational interviewing, but there's there's this thing called rolling with resistance kind of. And so you with motivational interviewing, you don't try to push something on people. You get them to start weighing the pros and cons of what they're doing. And then you get them to say, oh, well, wait a minute, maybe you know, I'd be better off if I changed. And then you try to work with them and elicit from them some change talk and get them to commit to changing. And that both, you know, this idea that you don't push them, you get them to kind of become uncomfortable with themselves and say, oh my God, you know, maybe, and they have to reach the decision to change. And then once they reach that decision, then you talk to them more. And it's really important to get them to start talking about change and to get them to commit to change. Okay, so those, that's the best I can answer that. Mm-hmm. Yes?
Question on the, as far as our state that I'm from, we have a high ratio of Matthew. Your patients who are, the clients that are HIV positive, you see a lot of IV drug use when using meth. Do you ever try to motivate them to maybe change over to smoking if they're not going to give up the meth, just smoking meth? Then you won't have that transmission
of the HIV
virus. We know we're not
going to
stop using meds altogether, but you know, at least maybe motivate them to use.
Yeah, I can't remember the exact number. The question was, have we thought about trying to get the people in our the HIV positive people who are injecting meth to stop injecting it and switch to smoking it to reduce onward transmission to other injectors. Okay, so, and I do a lot of work with injecting drug users. That wasn't really a focus of this study, and I think maybe out of the 39, there may have been like four of them who were injectors. And so the injection was pretty low in this. In terms of HIV in North Carolina, about 7% of injectors have HIV as in my studies, and it seems to be associated a lot with sexual transmission as much as with injection drug use. And so we have pretty low rates of, like in North Carolina, in a study of 850 IDUs I did in Raleigh-Durham, that I think about 50% reported that they had ever shared a syringe, and less than 20% reported sharing one in the past 30 days. And so it's, you know, and HCV prevalence was only 55%, which is actually pretty low for HCV. So that's any more questions?
Thanks, Bill.